You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And please do check out our website, KRUUFM.com, and help keep the station on the air by contributing what you can. This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon on this beautiful sunshine day.
Yeah, we haven't had winter yet, but I understand that it's not going to last.
Well, probably not, but I can dream.
I have a feeling it's going to be a mild winter.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't mind the cold, but it's the shoveling of the snow and stuff, and my driveway is a bad one. Other than that, I'm good, yeah.
So what do we have today, Mom?
Today we have an interesting book, and it's Women and the Land, and it's written by Barbara Hall, and photography by Catherine Gamble. The pictures are gorgeous of Iowa. This is Iowa at its best right here. Barbara Hall is a native Iowan and has never lived on a farm, but has driven past hundreds of them, blissfully unaware about who owned the land or what they were doing with it. Barbara has been writing stories since approximately the age of 10 and holds a journalism degree from Iowa State University. A former editor of Better Homes and Gardens magazine and other publications of Meredith Corporation, she has also worked in newspaper, advertising, and public relations. And this is her first book, and I would say it's a magnificent book.
And Women in the Land is published by Ice Cube Press out of North Liberty, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
It is. It really is. Well, Ice Cube Press, they do fantastic
they
work.
Do. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Barb.
Thank you.
All right. I got you a little loud, so the mic's a little close. Hold on a second. Okay. So tell us how this book came to be.
Well, Catherine Gamble, the photographer, and I were good friends, and we met 25 years ago or so when I was an editor at Meredith, and she was a photographer doing freelance work for the magazines I was working on. And we had always kind of talked about doing something together and just hadn't made it work. She's very, very busy now as a commercial photographer and has a young family. And about 5 or 6 years ago, she heard something on Iowa Public Radio that stated that more than 50% of the farmland in Iowa is owned by women. And she was intrigued by that, not so much about the statistic, but she wanted to know. She's a documentary photographer at heart, and she was just curious. She wanted to know who these women were and what they were doing and how they got there and why and all these things. And she was, frankly, just visualizing really great pictures of women on tractors, and that she thought they would make a really great documentary project. And she was right. And she asked me if I would be interested in working on that with her, and I said yes, because I knew it would be beautiful knowing her work. So we dug into it and started. Our first contact was to Women's Farm and Agriculture Network, WFAN, and got some names from them, and it just kind of snowballed from there. It was not hard to find women who are in some way connected to the land. There are many, many different ways that women come to it, and every one of these stories is unique. But like I said, we just kind of dug into it, not knowing exactly what it was going to be. We didn't know when we started that it was going to be a book. The first thing we did was we interviewed 4 or 5 of the women and photographed them and pitched the story to the Iowan magazine, and they jumped right on it, and it did run in the Iowan in, I believe, 2014 in the fall. But we knew it was, we didn't want to quit with just that. We knew it was bigger, and we kept finding out about more and more women, so we just kept going. And then maybe about 2 years ago, we realized that we had a book here and started thinking about it as a book, as a, you know, contained project. And from there, we just wanted to make sure we were representing the state geographically pretty well and also representing different genres of farming, you know, pigs, cows, corn, And making sure we just had a good variety of stories. And then we, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of wind farms in Iowa. Should we find a wind farmer? Yes, we should do that. And, oh, I read about a cricket farmer. Should we do a cricket farmer? Yes.
Oh, I love that story.
And a buffalo farmer. And
Buffalo farmer. Yeah, yeah.
So how? Well, so you ended up with 20.
About a year ago. Go ahead.
You ended up with 25 women that you profile?
26,
okay.
And some of the chapters are two or three women in one story. So there aren't 26 stories, but there are 26 women.
Oh, okay. Yes, sure. Okay. Yeah.
And how many of those would you say are traditional farmers, like what we think of with the
conventional
farming,
is what farming. They like to call it?
Right.
I would say maybe a 25% to 30% of them are farming conventionally, or at least they started that way and are maybe swinging a little bit to less conventional methods.
And
not all of them are actually farming it. Some of them just own it and are making decisions about it, but are not driving the tractors and
right. And when they say 50% of the farmland is owned by women, is that count including, are they counting if it's jointly owned? Are they including all of that, or are they including half of it if it's jointly owned?
The figure that we found, which was 3 or 4 years old now and came out of Iowa State, was that more than 51% of the land has at least one female owner.
Okay.
In conjunction with a husband or whatever. And then the statistic was more like 30% of the land is owned solely by a woman, which is still pretty high. When you imagine a farmer in Iowa, you don't think of a woman.
That's right.
30% is pretty high, and it's growing all the time. And a lot of the people that we've talked to who know about these things say that figure is really probably pretty low, just because of the way that farms are registered, and a lot of the times, even after the patriarch of the family has died, the land might not be in his daughter's name, even though she's the one that owns it. So it's probably not a completely accurate statistic. But and we weren't really that interested in the statistic. We were just more interested in telling these stories.
Uh-huh. Well, Caroline's part of that statistic, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I own some land in Davis County, and so 208 acres, 100 acres of trees.
And so, wow, a tree farmer. We didn't cover trees.
Oh, yeah.
The next book you
the
should cover trees.
The follow-up we'll give you a call.
Yeah. Yep, that's right.
Well, the tree, of course, it's in forest preserve, which really helps. And but they are gorgeous, gorgeous trees. And, you know, so every few years, of course, we harvest some of them. And that ash borer was a problem.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It's like the Dutch elm disease back in the, was it, 60s? Yeah. Just decimated the elm trees. And it's really sad.
It is the new Dutch elm.
Yep.
You know, it seems like for a long time, women did do a lot of the work around on the farm. Maybe they weren't necessarily out feeding the cat, you know, feeding the hogs every day, but they were during harvest time, you know, they were out driving the tractor, they kept the books, they, you know, organized things.
They were employed full-time as a farmer, but they were called the farm wife.
Right, and they didn't get much credit for it. Our tax system doesn't give them credit for them. The Social Security system didn't give them much credit for it. Yeah, so it's nice to...
One of the women that we featured, Mary Garst, who we're fortunate enough to interview and photograph about 6 months before she died. We're just so glad we met her. But she, this was back in the 70s, I believe. She was a farm wife. She was not a typical farm wife, as you'll read if you read her chapter, but she asked her husband to pay her.
Mm.
Oh.
Very revolutionary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, I noticed a lot of younger women in your young women in your stories, and of course, farm machinery has gotten so much more sophisticated now than it was, you know, before, and I think probably easier to manipulate, perhaps, than it would have been back in the day. And that probably made a big difference too. I know tractors are something else. And
yeah.
So how did you decide, out of all these women farmers or women of the land in Iowa, how did you decide which ones? And did you interview more than you actually ended up including in the book?
We did not interview more than we included. We did a little bit of research on them and determined, you know, once we found out about them, you know, that we did want to spend the time and put them in the project. There were a few that we contacted that weren't interested. We just couldn't get them interested. Mostly because of time constraints, and most of that was pretty early on, and we didn't have any cred. You know, we were two ladies from Des Moines, and we're going to come out and take pictures of you and, you know, take up your valuable time. They just weren't interested in that. But once we had the Iowan article done, then we would send that out. When we were trying to recruit somebody new, we would send that to give us just a little street cred that, yes, this is a project, we're continuing with it, we'd like you to be a part of it. And we did have one woman turn us down after we sent that to her, because she detected a tone there that we were anti-conventional farming, and we really, really weren't and aren't. We just, the theme kind of emerged, surprisingly to us, that women do seem to be taking better care of the land than their predecessors. They do seem to be a little more concerned and aware of the fact that we're growing food here, folks, and we need to be making sure that it's healthy and making sure that we leave a good legacy for our children. And you know, I keep saying this isn't good research. It's not even good journalism. We didn't go out and interview men and compare them to women. So it may be just that everyone today is taking better care of the land. That is quite possible. But these women care very deeply about the land and about what's grown on it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Barbara Hall, author of Women and the Land, which features Iowa farm women.
And it would make a very nice Christmas gift,
it would,
by the way.
It would. Now, tell us, Barbara, how you got connected with Ice Cube Press.
Once we determined that it was a book, we kind of felt, both of us have been around the publishing world long enough to know that it's really hard to get a book published. And we really thought it was going to be a self-published venture, and we started looking into that. And then the woman that designed the book for us, Jolene Rivera, said, you know, this is going to be so good. You guys should at least try to find a publisher. So we started shopping around a little bit, and Steve Semkin at Ice Cube Press was recommended to us by several people. And we pitched it to three or four different people, and a couple were interested and the others weren't. And we went with Steve just because of the, you know, things that we liked about him and Ice Cube Press.
Well, one thing is that he focuses on books of the Midwest and,
right,
you know, that have a sense of place, which obviously this, where place is an important part of the book, actually.
Yeah, yes, that was one of the things that really attracted us to him and his business.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about the process of doing this. Did you... like you'd interview someone, would you complete that essay before you would move on to the next one? Or did you have all these notes from interviews and then you sat down and started writing? Or
kind of both. Catherine's schedule is very, very, very busy. I'm busy, but not as busy as she is. And so trying to schedule her time was the biggest challenge. And I would initiate the contact with the farmer and ask if it was, you know, if we could come out and, you know, set up a photo shoot and an interview. We both went, generally we went together and took the pictures and did the interview, you know, all in one fell swoop, so we wouldn't have to take up too much of the woman's time. And also because we are good friends and we enjoy being together. So there were times when we'd schedule three or four in a couple days, you know, in one part of the state, and we'd, you know, maybe stay overnight, or I don't know if we ever did two in one day, but we might have done. There might have been a couple where we did two in one day. But we would, I would find out as much as I could ahead of time so I could ask intelligent questions, but and some of them have a lot of stuff about them written already, like Denise O'Brien. There's a wealth of information about her. There's a wealth of information about the Garst family. So I didn't have to do all that, ask them all those background questions.
Mm.
But right. We would go there together, and generally while Catherine was scoping out the farm and finding a perfect spot for a good photograph, I would be sitting there with my notebook with the farmer and asking her some questions. And that was kind of a start, and then I just, you know, tagged along while we got the, you know, the photographs. And often I was having to be the assistant to Catherine too and hold the lights or whatever. But I would keep talking and keep asking questions, and as many good journalists will know, the best stuff comes out sometimes when the notebook comes put down. So I would, you know, try to remember what they said if I wasn't holding the notebook. But in a couple cases, I would have to follow up with a phone call or to just clarify some details. And I also made sure that I sent each woman the chapter about her, because this has been a more than five-year process. And some of the details changed, and I couldn't go back and rewrite every single one of them, the ones that we had been to 5 years ago, but I could update some things. And so it was just kind of a process.
Wow. Okay, the one that was really...
And once we had about 15, then we took a look to see where our gaps were, and we realized, oh, we don't have any cows. We got to find some cows. So we, you know, contacted the people we knew to see, do you know any women that are dairy farmers? And then that's when, oh, the cricket thing came up, and a couple other things kind of came up at the last minute. There were a few others that were recommended to us once people knew that we were doing this, and a lot of the ones that we just weren't interested in probably would have made great stories, but they were kind of redundant to some of the things we'd already did, and we didn't feel the need for a lot of redundancy.
Okay, the one that I was really intrigued was the cricket farmer.
Yeah, the cricket.
Yeah, because you know that's really unusual. Really unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah, so can you tell us how you stumbled upon that one?
Well, yeah, it was kind of an accident. My full-time job, my day job, the one that pays a few years ago was part of a statewide organization that helps innovative businesses or startup businesses get funding. And Becky Herman had applied to get some funding from the state for her entrepreneurial venture. And I was at an event where she was pitching her business to win some prize money. And I listened to the pitch, and it was really fascinating and interesting. And she was adorable, so I knew she would be a great addition to the book. So I think I took some pictures of her on my phone and sent them to Catherine and said, "What do you think?" And you know, of course, we got to do cricket farming.
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine how loud that barn must be where she grows them.
Not loud at all. They're not your black crickets that make noise. They're,
oh.
they're if you look at the pictures, there's little brown insects, and so I don't know that much about crickets to know which ones make noise and which don't, but that, it was completely quiet. And it's not even a barn. It's a building that's a former restaurant, and it's not very big. But they have these Rubbermaid bins stacked on, you know, shelves that are three or four bins high, and it's very quiet and clean. And
well, I know that crickets are great protein, but
yeah.
I just can't get over the ick factor.
Well, yeah, but yeah, so they grind.
Yeah.
They grind.
When I first met her and saw her presentation, she had some samples, and this was before she even had. I don't think she'd even started yet. I can't remember, but she had a sample, a bag that looked like a bag of chips, and she was carrying it around at this presentation, and so she invited me to try some, and I reached my hand in and grabbed a handful, because I'd watched her eat them, and I could see that, you know, she ate them, so they must be okay. And I think if I wouldn't have looked at them before I put them in my mouth, I would have been completely okay. Yeah, and they had eyes and antennae and ugh.
Oh no!
But they didn't. Yeah, they didn't taste bad at all. But generally, most of the crickets are ground up,
yeah,
and used
ground
in
up.
Cricket flour that yeah. are used in protein bars and things like that.
Yeah.
You don't You know, you don't.
You don't see the antenna.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah, it,
oh
it my. Would it would be hard to do to eat that. But a lot of in a lot of cultures in the world, bugs is, you know, standard fare.
Well, what?
The thing I think the thing that was surprising to me about the cricket farming is the sustainability part of it. And I'm not going to remember the statistics, but they take so much fewer resources to grow the same amount of protein as a cow.
Well,
so an equal amount of protein from a piece from a hamburger, the hamburger takes so many more resources to produce that.
Oh yeah,
and
I mean that's kind of true with all of our
and
food.
Soil and all sorts of stuff.
The energy that goes into producing food, that particularly that's being grown and shipped from far away, far exceeds the caloric energy that we get from the food, and that's you know there really is. I'm associated with a group here in Fairfield called the Sustainable Living Coalition, and we're promoting local food sources. And that does seem to be a theme that has emerged from this is, you know, we've got wonderful land here, but almost all the food we eat is being shipped in.
Yeah, 80% is one statistic.
Right. And so farmers are looking at that and saying, hey, maybe there's some opportunity here.
Yeah, and another statistic I heard was that if every county in Iowa would put aside 10 acres of land to grow food on, we could feed our entire state 100%. 10 acres.
10 acres?
That's not very...
Are you sure about that?
I'm not. That's something that was quoted to me, and I'm not sure about that. But
wow.
It was somebody who knows what she's talking about.
Wow.
Who said that.
Wow. The problem is that we're also used to eating all things all the time, and if you're relying on local food production, you can only eat what's in season, fresh.
But we grew up doing that, and I feel weird eating strawberries in the winter. I still feel weird eating watermelon in the winter. I want to eat food when it's in season, and people that are younger than us, I don't think care about that so much.
So, Barb, why don't you read from Women in the Land for us? Women and the Land.
Yeah, I'm going to read the chapter about Liz Garth, who's in Guthrie County. Fresh from a prairie bird and clad in bright yellow fire gear, Liz Garth climbs out of a gator in the parking lot of the Burr Oak Visitor Center near Coon Rapids. With a sweeping gesture of her left hand, she points out the 5,000-plus acre White Rock Conservancy, a land trust donated by the Garth family. With a sweep of her other arm, she points toward the famous Garst Farm, site of the 1959 visit by Nikita Khrushchev. The granddaughter of Khrushchev's host, Roswell and Elizabeth Garst, Liz credits her mother with bearing the standard for Iowa women in agriculture. And then I make a reference to the chapter about Mary Garst, her mother. Liz Garst followed in her mother's footsteps and then put on bigger boots. She holds a degree in English literature from Stanford, a master's in agriculture economics from Michigan State, and a master's in business from Harvard. There have always been women landowners, but women are starting to better understand that if they own it, they control it, Liz says. In 1990, she told the Iowa Division of a United Nations Association conference that while more than 50% of the land in Iowa is owned by women, they don't act like they own it. Increasingly, she believes, that control involves an emphasis on conservation. When she was 16 years old, her grandfather bought a farm for all 15 Garst cousins to manage. We took all the profits and invested in building terraces, she says. Her ancestors have been terracing their land for generations, and Liz believes it's the most effective method for preventing erosion. Her father was an early adopter of no-till farming and other basic sustainable ag practices. To those, Liz has added planting cover crops such as tillage, radishes, and rye. No-till stops erosion but doesn't build the soil, she explains as she pulls a radish from her garden near her farmhouse. Cover crops do both, adding carbon to the soil and fixing the nitrogen. With the right balance of cover crops, you can cut commercial fertilizer and increase your yield. Liz is also involved in conservation on the state level as a member of the Iowa Environmental Council Board of Directors and also on the board of White Rock Conservancy. White Rock is open to the public for a number of recreational activities, including hiking, horseback riding, mountain biking, and canoeing. The Conservancy also sponsors conservation projects like timber stand improvement, prescribed burns, cover crop research, and prairie strips in crop fields. Mm-hmm. Getting people here is part of our mission, Liz says, about White Rock. We want people to learn about conservation. Environmentalists don't like cows. Farmers don't like people looking at their cows. We set this up so people can look at cows and prairie and learn about the land they live on. I think the more we know about it, the more likely we are to care for it.
Amen, that's for sure.
And that was Barbara Hall reading from Women and the Land, which is a beautiful book.
And oh, it is. It really is.
It's just really interesting to me, all the different ways that women have come to farming. Some married into it, some inherited it, some and some came to it totally independently.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by the number of women that we interviewed anyway who grew up on a farm, moved away saying, "Go, I'm out of here. I'm never coming back," and then have come back.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a couple I can think of at least one woman that I went to high school with who stayed here and took over the family farm and really, you know, did everything. she did it all.
Another thing I like about this book is there's a lot of quotes from people in it.
Yes. Yeah, how did you pick the quotes?
I started Googling quotes. You know, I used some keywords and found some things, and then tried to match the quote with the tone with the woman. Let me see. For example, I'm clipping through here. For Jan Libby, who's up near Clear Lake, somebody from something from Vandana Shiva. We are either going to have a future where women lead the way to make peace with the earth, or we are not going to have a human future at all. Mm. I did two or three from A Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett, including the one on Susan Arum's chapter where she's talking about growing earth and about these kids that are coming to her farm to do internships, and they just want to touch the earth. And the quote is, "Might I, Quavered Mary, might I have a bit of earth?"
Mm. So, Barb, you must be really pleased with how the book turned out.
Oh, I am. I'm very pleased and proud. But I'm not surprised. You know, I know Catherine's work, and I knew it was going to be beautiful. And as I talked to each woman, I knew that it was going to be interesting. So I'm not surprised that it's good. I am kind of surprised at how well it's being received. I'm surprised and overwhelmed and humbled. It's just, well, we've struck a chord, I guess, and
yes.
I'm surprised by that.
Do you think there'll be volume two?
I don't know. We're talking about doing something. I don't know if it'll be women or women farmers or something completely different, but we definitely would like to do another project together.
Well, that sounds like a great idea, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been talking with Barb Hall, author of Women in the Land. You can certainly check out Ice Cube Press website, order it from there or from any independent bookstore or, of course, your normal Amazons and Barnes and Nobles too. And now we have a second Ice Cube Press author, and let me just take a moment here.
Well, we'll do that. I want to do this last
quote.
Okay, this is from your book. "Those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life." And that was Rachel Carson. And of course she is well known for her environmental things. So once again, congratulations on your book.
All right, and we will be right back with guest number two. Back with Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our second guest today is
Ethel Barker. And Ethel is the daughter of a Danish Lutheran pastor, spent a happy childhood in Dwight, Illinois, rural Iowa between Cedar Falls and Dyke, Salinas, California, and Des Moines, Iowa. Her degrees are AA from Grandview College, Des Moines, a BA, and MAT from University of Iowa. She taught remedial reading in junior high to junior high students, and in so doing recognized the need for books that educate while holding students' interest. At an early age, when two little girls were happily playing school, her sister taught her to read. ever since, she has found great delight in books. She currently lives with her husband, a retired high school principal in Iowa City. For the Love of Pete, An Orphan Train Story was her first novel. The Andersons of Eden is her second. And I could really identify with this, because this was, I grew up in, I was born in 1935, so I was in that.
In Iowa.
So I was in that era that this is.
The Andersons of Eden. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ethel.
Thank you so much.
Now, is this your childhood time period also, or?
Yes, I was 6 years old on Pearl Harbor Day in December of 1941.
Oh, so you're exactly the same age as Caroline.
Yep.
Is that right?
That's
wonderful.
Right. And what made you want to write a novel about that time?
Well, I had already written the book For the Love of Pete, An Orphan Train Story, that took place in 1880, and I thought this time it would be fun to write of a period that I knew, and also I felt we're losing our World War II veterans so quickly. I wanted to write mm-hmm. this book mm-hmm. while we still had some of them. And I, the man to whom I dedicated the book, George Dane, is in a retirement home and is not really well. I wanted very much to get his story in the book.
So the letters that the soldiers, the members of this family, wrote back to their sister mainly, but to their families, telling about their experiences in the war. How is that because of this gentleman that you knew all those things, that you could relate them?
No, the interview I got with George Dane was the one about the Battle of the Bulge. It's towards the end of the book,
uh-huh.
And so he was young when the war started, but he was in it, and his story I gave to Cousin Orville, who's not anything like George Dane. George Dane is a little more sophisticated fellow than Cousin Orville, but his story worked so well for Cousin Orville, so I used it.
Okay, so you had to research the other things about the battles and so forth.
Yes, then. Most of it. I had two other people who contributed a lot. One was Danielle Zimmerman, who told me her experience with polio, because Stanley, one of the boys in the family, experiences polio and does recover, and mm-hmm. she did too, gave me a wonderful story that I used. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was Pat Kniebel, who told me about a member of her family who had been declared missing in action. And when the word came, well, they'd suffered, you know, knowing that their family member was missing in action and thinking the worst. And then the word came back that, no, he was found, he was well, everything was all right. And she told me how her brother had been so thrilled with the news that he ran barefoot to town and rang the church bell. So I used that also for Stanley to do in honor of his brother.
Well, I had two uncles in the war. One was a foot soldier in Germany, and he in the army, and he came out without a scratch. I still can't believe that, and he's still living.
Yeah.
And then my other uncle was a mechanic. He joined the Air Force, and he was in England, stationed in England. He was a mechanic on B-29s or whatever it was, the bombers. So he had some interesting stories to tell. So. You know, I grew up hearing this stuff, and that's why I just loved. I read this book, couldn't put it down. It's just great.
I have heard that from people of our age who do have personal stories, and mm-hmm. I wish I had heard them all before I wrote the book. I've heard some good ones ever since.
Well, you could write another book.
Yes, I could. Well, I am writing another one, but on another subject.
Uh-huh. Okay, I have to tell you, I don't know how old I was when that this newscaster was at H.V. Kaltenborn.
Yes,
he had a very distinctive voice and presentation. I used to imitate him.
Can you still do it?
No, because I
can't. Come on, Mom.
I can't remember what he sounded like, but my mother couldn't tell if it was him or me.
Oh,
I've always been able to imitate, you know. Things.
See, that would have been a fun little detail to put in, too, wouldn't it?
It's fabulous. I could have had one of the characters doing that.
Yeah, Stanley. I could see Stanley doing that for sure.
And the other thing was watching my grandmother. Watching
yeah, I can tell you're familiar with my characters.
Yep.
The other thing was watching my grandmother beating eggs for her cake with a wire whisk. Mm. And
my mother did too.
Yeah, she had blue ribbons from the Iowa State Fair for her interfood cake too. So yeah,
wonderful. Well, my mother didn't enter the fair, but she had wonderful, wonderful cake.
Now, in some ways, it seemed like such an idyllic time. Was it really? You know,
well, for me it was. The kid, you know, since we did not have, in my family, my brother was too young, my father was too old, so we did not suffer as many families did. Mm. But many people in our church certainly suffered through this, and I heard some of the stories. However, I was too young to understand the gravity of what was going on, and afterwards I certainly did.
Mm. Well, I remember going to newsreels, you know, and because we didn't really know what was going on in Europe.
Concentration camps,
right, no,
and things.
We didn't know that until they were liberated.
Right.
And but gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
Now
it came toward the end of the war, our awareness.
Yes.
And it was horrible, but we were unaware of that.
I'm curious, Ethel, you the family, the Andersons, you know, have five children, four boys and a girl. Mm-hmm. And you take a point of view through most of the book of one of the sons.
Yes.
Rather than the daughter. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I wanted Ben to tell the story. He was the youngest boy, and I knew he was going to have to go. My husband's brother, my husband didn't go till Korea, but his brother next older than he, and I thought that was a good point of view. And even though I probably would identify more with the girls, I thought this is a war that was mostly, although there were wax waves and spars and nurses who certainly took a big part, but at the time we were mostly thinking of our soldier boys, and so I gave the narrator role to Ben.
Well,
of the boys,
of course, Betsy
and the twin of Betsy.
Yeah, Betsy being a historian, and you know, really an interesting character. I thought she added a great deal to it, just by the way that she you know, encouraged her brothers and so forth.
I also found it really interesting the father, the character of the father, who had had been in World War I, and how that impacted him. And you know, the way that you bring that story out was very touching.
Well, I thought that was important to include that, because so many people today coming back from warfare, we call it PTSD now. Back then it was called shell shock in World War I, and it had another name in World War II. But it's the same thing, coming home just broken and having seen their friends die, and in a horrible way. So I felt it was important at least to include some of that, and the father did not want his sons to have to experience that same thing, but there was not much choice. They could have taken the farm deferment, but they chose not to, mm-hmm. because they felt their friends all had to go, and that they would go too.
Did you do much research on that, about the farm deferment and whether people did go and how it was? I mean, in this book, in The Andersons of Eden, the farm boys who did take the deferment were criticized by the community. Was that common?
Well, I got that idea from my husband, who's they were four boys in his family, just as there were in the Anderson family. Not his oldest brother, but the next to the oldest, was a farmer. He was working. He didn't own a farm, but he was working on a farm, and he was offered the deferment, and he took it. And he experienced this. He didn't like to go to town because he experienced that feeling that you're not doing what we have to do, and we don't like it. Mm-hmm. So that's where I got that idea.
But in reality, without the farmers, there wouldn't be any food to feed
Absolutely.
The troops.
And many young men did take the farm deferment, and it was an honorable thing to do, and we needed it.
Yes.
But I used that particularly because of my brother-in-law that had experienced such a bad feeling.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's interesting because even many, many years later, when I married into an Iowa farm family, and I learned that there was still some resentment in the community between the families where the boys had gone to war and the ones where they stayed home.
Because I really depended on my brother-in-law's.
Yeah.
The ones who stayed home, it actually continued. I mean, it wasn't just that they went off to war or didn't, but the ones who stayed home had a head start on buying up land and, became the wealthier farmers of the community.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, I should have talked to you about that before I wrote the book. That's very interesting.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about that, but of course that would be true. Yeah.
Sure. No, that is very interesting. I'm getting so many stories now after the book, and I really enjoy it, hearing how people can identify with this family.
Did you have some source documents to refer to, letters from the front? Or anything like that?
Did the letters I had were not particularly illuminating. They were very humdrum, and everything interesting was blocked out.
Yeah. I saw some.
So mostly what I depended upon was my research. Books. We've got wonderful libraries in Iowa City, both the State Historical Society and our university library and our public library, both in Iowa City and Coralville, and then I use the internet for a lot of things too. So whenever I hit a glitch, I had plenty of places to go and find information.
Was it hard sometimes to remember, you know, technology has changed so quickly in your lifetime. Was it hard to remember what was available then and what wasn't, you know, what things maybe didn't show up until 1950, and so you can't put them in, you know, into the story in 1940.
No, it really wasn't, because I lived through it, and it was real easy to remember the things from school, the collecting the rubber and the metal and the milkweed floss, all those things, and buying the little stamp, the war that we exchanged for war bonds. I remember doing that every week, bringing either a dime or a quarter and hoping we would fill that book. And when it was full, I think it was $18.75 worth of little stamps, then we could exchange it for a war bond that was worth $25. That seemed a huge amount of money to a kid back in those days. Yeah. And of course, we'd save it for college. It sounds funny now, but back then, dollars—the value of dollars was so very different.
So, did you use some of those war bonds for college?
Oh yeah, I saved them. Of course, it cost more than that, but it was nice to have them.
Yeah,
and of course the my mother canned everything, and so did my grandmother, and. And then there was rationing. There was rationing of certain things.
Yes, I we Well, we lived in my early childhood. Dad had a country congregation, but when I was a little bit older and it was still wartime, we moved to California, and the town of Salinas, California, and our home and our church were very close to downtown. I could just walk around the corner when Mother ran out of butter or eggs or something and get that for her, but I had to have my stamps for certain things.
Oh, yeah.
And also for shoes, for so many things, but I remember that very well, too.
Yeah.
So for those kinds of things, I didn't have to research.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're speaking with Ethel Barker, author of The Andersons of Eden, the story of an Iowa family during World War II. Ethel, would you like to read from the book?
Oh, sure.
Oh, great.
I'm not sure. Just I'd have so many places I could read from, but I will read about when Clarence was missing in action. And then you tell me if I need to read something else, I will.
Okay.
Okay. As everybody else was talking about the war, a never-ending subject in our family. This is Ben, by the way, that's telling this story. A jalopy drove up the lane. I heard bits of gravel knocking about. It was an old 1928 Model A, long out of style, but nobody could buy a new car during the war. Carl Jensen drove it all over the county, delivering a telegram. No! There came a hard knock at the kitchen door, and Mom cried out, "No, Carl, no!" Claudia, Stanley, Betsy, and I all ran. Claudia's Clifford, the oldest boy's wife, by the way. Claudia, Stanley, Betsy, and I all ran into the kitchen and got there just in time to watch Carl Jensen seat corn cap in his left hand with a face like folks show at a funeral, hand the telegram to Mom. He looked like he'd rather be anyplace else. Dad came running from the barn, leaping across puddles from the rain that had fallen the night before. Grandpa and Grandma hobbled in, white-faced, and for a moment all you could hear was the clock ticking. Mom ripped open the telegram and began to sob. Dad grabbed it and mumbled, "Clarence, missing in action." Claudia, that's Clarence's wife, went white as the head of a bald eagle, swaying like she was about to faint. But she didn't. Strangely, she was braver than the rest of us. Mom and Betsy were crying like crazy. Of course, Grandma was spouting Bible verses. Stanley, Dad, and Grandpa stood with their hands in their pockets as if they couldn't figure out what to do. Clarence had barely left the States. How could this happen? He wrote that he had a safe job. War is a crazy mess. Oh, how I hated this. We were used to solving all kinds of problems on the farm, but this was something we couldn't fix. Now, I'm going to skip a bit because they are suffering over this for several days until they get a phone call in the middle of the night. I will just read a bit here. All I could think of was Clarence missing in action. I hated, Stanley has been strutting around, so he hates it because Stanley is going to become a warrior. I hated watching Stanley strut around like that. Who do you think you are? General MacArthur? You're giving Mom palpitations. I'll most likely have to wait till after graduation, Stanley said, but I'm not sticking around like a draft dodger. Besides, you'll be here. Dad can't complain that he doesn't have help. You've turned into a better farmer than I'd ever be. The two of you will manage just fine. The message about Clarence left us feeling empty, and with all of Stanley's talk about joining up, it was even worse. I can't remember much of what we did the next 4 days. Seemed like besides doing chores, we often just sat in silence, except for Grandma's Bible verses, and I don't remember those either. Mom spent her nights by the radio knitting. After I went to bed, I couldn't sleep. Eventually, I was so worn out, I did nod off. It was like being dead. But then one night, in one of the darkest hours, the phone rang. The usual two shorts and a long. Shook me up like butter in a churn. Our phone seldom rang in the day and never at night. Both Stanley and I popped out of bed. He 2 steps ahead of me. We raced down the stairs, and Stanley managed to get there before anybody else. the rest of the upstairs family came tumbling after me. In my drowsy state, I heard Stanley repeat what Carl Jensen had told him on the phone. Yep, ungodly hour, but I knew you'd want to know. Clarence is alive, not even hurt. Following those words, tears rang out like the ear-splitting noise at a football game after a touchdown. Stanley's reaction was different than what came out of the rest of us. Once he'd reported the news, he spun around and raced out the back door, slamming it behind him. I yanked it back and followed him into the darkness. There was moonlight enough that I could watch him run like a spooked horse down the driveway and in towards town in his bare feet, his blue striped pajamas flapping like an American flag. The rest of the family came out, even Grandpa and Grandma hobbled along from their little house out back. When we told them the wonderful news, they held each other and cried. Mom dug an elbow into Dad's side. Hadn't you better chase after Stanley? Nope, Dad said. The boy's high-strung. Got to do what he's got to do. I headed back to bed but couldn't sleep. Pretty soon I heard the church bell ringing. It rang at least 100 times, maybe more, chimes that sang out the way I felt, as if I was almost busting out of my skin. I ran back downstairs. Everybody was laughing, crying, and hugging each other like we'd all got killed, and then found out there really was a heaven. Waited up for Stanley to come home. When he finally did, he was breathless, and his feet were cut up and bloody. You shouldn't run barefoot on the gravel, Grandma said. Clarence's wife brought soap and a pan of water. She carefully washed Stanley's feet, dried them, and painted the cuts with Mercurochrome, a kind and lovely gesture, and a sight I will never forget.
That was Ethel.
About the right amount.
That's great. That's yeah. Ethel Barker reading from The Andersons of Eden. So, Ethel, did you know kind of the outline of the story before you started writing?
No, I didn't. I don't write that way. Writing comes more naturally to me if I think up the characters and really build them up in my mind so they're real people to me, and then they act as they would act. Of course, there was a natural progression of this book because of the war, and I did have a timeline of all the things that happened during the war, all the battles, and so that really made it easy to fit the personal things around them. But no, I really just love to have the characters tell their own story.
Well, you know, you do have a lot of World War II history in here.
Yes.
It would be a really fun way for kids to learn histories by reading this book.
It would, yeah. And to realize that we were...
That's why I like to write historical fiction, because I have taught children that, sometimes need a little encouragement to read. And if you can make it interesting and fun, they're much more likely to learn their history lesson as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because, you know, we were fighting on two fronts, which was very difficult, you know.
Yes, it was. And toward the end of the book, there's more about the war in the Pacific.
Well, sure. Yeah.
So, Ethel, tell us about your path to publication. Now, this is your second book that you published. Was the first one also with Ice Cube Press?
Yes, it is. I think Ice Cube Press is wonderful, and I really like working with Steve Simkin. And he had a very good intern that worked as an editor for me, and we had a great working relationship. So For the Love of Pete was the first book that I published with them. It's an orphan train story taking place in 1880 in Iowa. I love to write about Iowa. And it's children that were street kids in New York with not much going for them. And, many of those children just died in the streets. And a wonderful opportunity came when Reverend Charles Loring Brace discovered the horror of the lives of these children, and arranged for the railroads were new, and he arranged for transportation to take them to various towns in the United States and even Canada and Mexico. And so the trains would stop. The children, it was a very unusual way to do this, but the children were displayed and people came and the child and took them home.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, some of them didn't get very good homes, though.
That's right. And that happened to Pete, is this story. But the little girls fared better, especially the little one. And I do like happy endings, so... Yeah, eventually we rescue Pete.
Now, have you always wanted to be a writer?
Oh, I've always loved writing, but I had not thought about doing that as a vocation. I just did it for fun. But it began going, well, I went for many, 10 years, I think, 10 summers, to the University of Iowa Writing Festival.
And, me too.
Learned a great deal there and about fiction writing. And then I just thought it was time to publish, and I met Steve Simpkin of Ice Cube Press, and it's been wonderful ever since.
Oh, wow. So you're working on another book now?
Yes, I am.
Is it also a historical novel?
It is about Iowa as well, and I'm going farther back in history to 1835.
Ooh.
This is before we were a state or even a territory. We were part of the Michigan Territory at that time. And so there's all kinds of adventures can come to. Two families coming out in their covered wagon from Ohio. And so I'm having a lot of fun doing that.
Well, part of our family came by covered wagon from Ohio.
Wonderful. Yeah. And where did they come from?
I'd have to look it up, but I have a dresser in my bedroom. It's a cherry dresser, and there's a card on the back that says, "This dresser came on covered wagon from Ohio."
No kidding! That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, I would love to have more of your family history, because I keep learning more and more as I go along. It's surprising the amount of information that is available.
I will send you some, because we have a lot. Our family did come to Iowa about that time, in the mid-1800s, and we have a lot of information.
Is there a Belmont?
I would love that.
Is there a Belmont county in Ohio?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll look it up. We have it. We've had people do some of our ancestors did all the genealogy, and we have all the information going way back.
Oh, send me whatever you can.
I would love that.
Okay,
that's
great.
Wonderful. Well, Ethel, it's been such a pleasure having you today. The Andersons of Eden, the story of an Iowa family during World War II. And this is available at icecubepress.com and also any bookstore could order it. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. And, Mom, do you have some closing words for
us
today? I do.
About is actually about war. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will have peace.
Do you know who said that?
Nope.
No.
No. Well, let's just hope it comes true.
Amen.
Stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Earth's Wild, and the show will also be rebroadcast Monday morning beginning at 8 a.m. And we'll see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks so much.
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.